This is Setting the Record Straight. And I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. And we're brought to you on BreadboxMedia.com. On this Setting the Record Straight, we're going to take up again some of the material in Maria Luisa Ambrosini's wonderful book, The Secret Archives of the Vatican. There's so much in the archives, so much that's unknown in the secret archives, even today, never been examined. But Maria Luisa has told us some fascinating stories in her book. She spent several years investigating the material in the archives. And by the way, I must remind you once again, the archives are not secret. An archaic definition of the word secret means private. This is the Pope's private collection, the Pope's private archives. I've got to bring you more of it as we go along. So this is one of several more programs I'm going to do on this subject. What was in the archives? Well, pagan literature, as well as Catholic sacred literature. Scrolls on codices. A codex is a book. Some of it just stacked in folders. It was on parchment. Papyrus was imported into Europe from Egypt until the rise of the Muslims sort of cut off that source. So after that, parchment was used. A lot of it was produced by copyists in the scriptoria. These are the writing labs of the monasteries. Producing beautiful copies of books became an art form. But the works produced by these scriptores were great artworks, but they had a great practical value also. You could think of the scriptoria as an early form of printer's shops, sort of the writing labs in the monasteries. There were book publishers, very slow book publishers. So let's take our minds back. Put your time travel boots on. Let's come back into the late 400s, the early 500s. That sort of encompasses the life of St. Benedict. He was born about 480, died about 547, Anno Domini. In the last Setting the Record Straight on this subject, I talked about him. I talked about St. Benedict and his monasteries in which he had scriptoria. Of course, he's famous for founding the Benedictine monks and setting up the rules for the modest and ordinary life that the monks lived, the rule of St. Benedict. Well, Benedict looked at the books for their practical value, for their use in evangelizing and scholarship. So he emphasized it, but not the artistic end. That happened anyway. By the way, there was no printing for centuries after this. It was possible to create a complete woodblock of one page, laboriously sculpt it out, but they didn't have movable type, and so books were copied in the scriptoria. And Benedict had a scriptoria simply because of its practical use. Also living about the same time, around the year 500, another monk who founded monasteries was very important in preserving literacy in Italy. His name was Cassiodorus. Cassiodorus realized that the Catholic Church was living on its intellectual capital, and much of that capital had been inherited from the pagan world. So they copied Catholic manuscripts and pagan too. Cassiodorus taught the practical usefulness to Catholicism of the study of pagan literature. And he's the one that adapted the trivium and quadrivium curricula to Catholic education. This man, Cassiodorus, succeeded in slipping literature and science into the vocational school curriculum. While Benedict and Cassiodorus were preserving literacy in Italy, Cassiodorus intentionally, the monks of the Irish Church were performing the same service for civilization. Ireland's dark ages had not yet begun. They would come soon enough when the Northmen attacked. But in those days, the Irish Church was wealthy and learned and could draw on rich intellectual reserves. The Irish culture was a civilization that worshipped excellence of body and mind. No man of imperfect body or ugly face could become a king or that other exalted post, bard. Even the fairies, a legendary race of a little less than human size, were famed for their horse breeding, and the bogs of Ireland have yielded the bones of prehistoric cattle that must have been fine agricultural animals. They even had a national archives. The Irish culture, however, depended largely on oral transmission. This was the bards who told and retold the nation's traditions. These bards were allowed to wear nearly as many colors as the king, and they molded public opinion, the media, again. But this oral culture did develop writing,
And into this remnant of the great megalithic culture came St. Patrick with the drive, the skill in public relations, and the staff of a modern mass evangelist. He had 150 assistants. He used a choir of harpers to draw crowds. When he had Catholicized a place, he left staff members behind to see that they stayed Catholics. By the end of the 6th century, Ireland had become Catholic, and it brought to the Catholic Church a genetic and cultural wealth that was not spent for many generations, along with a joyous enthusiasm that expressed itself in action as well as in prayer. So the monasteries, whether Italian or Irish, provided special workrooms, the scriptoria, for the copying of manuscripts and codices. And typically they had a large table in the middle with a copyist sitting at comfortable book racks near the windows. They used a reed or quill pen. The Romans had slit steel pens. Scriptura were nothing new. The Romans had carried on mass copying with a reader dictating material to a room full of scribes. And there had even been bookshops on the Forum. The early church, even before the time of Emperor Constantine, had produced books for circulation through the Catholic communities. And they sent these books out to foreign churches. And even those foreign churches had some sort of scriptorium to copy them. Popular writers had private scriptoria, like Origen. According to the Benedictine rule, each monastery had to have a library. Even though the number of books was small, seldom over about 100, it likely contained biblical commentary and patristic writings, and maybe recent history, lives of saints, martyrs, textbooks, Catholic poetry, and a few pagan classics.
I'm sure you have heard of Gregory the Great, St. Gregory the Great. He was a pope. He was born around the mid-500s, lived up to 604 AD. And we have a great deal of his writing, somehow preserved, miraculously preserved. Well, he produced a great deal of writing. We know much more about him than
about his predecessors,
or indeed about any pope for the next 500 years. Thanks to the archives, we have more of his letters. 854 of them have survived, even though the register in its physical form has disappeared. A later pope, Adrian I, began the collection by extracting 686 letters from Gregory's original voluminous register. Now there are over 100 manuscripts containing Gregory's letters. These are copies. Part of the register must have been secret, the letters in which Gregory tries to break the ties between the Gauls and the Lombards, and his very personal exchanges with the emperor at Byzantium. So this register, when it no longer served the active files, would have been placed in the papal archives at the Lateran, where Gregory himself mentions having placed his sermons. And by the 9th century, they were still there, alongside a very large volume listing the name, age, and sex of the persons helped by the church in Gregory's pontificate. It was in the form of 14 rolls of papyrus that corresponded to Gregory's 14 years as pope. We do know that the archives were at the Lateran Palace in the century of Gregory's death. It's referred to in a 7th century document in the daily journal, the Liber Diurnus. It says, in the archives of Our Lady of the Holy Roman Church, in the sacred scrinium of the Lateran. This scrinium was very likely under the chapel of the Sancta Sanctorum and the Holy Stairs. Those are the steps of Tyrrhenian marble that Constantine's mother had brought back from Pilate's house. I've seen those stairs. It's very moving. These are the stairs upon which Christ was scourged and which he had dragged himself up bleeding. They're still there. They're outdoors. The Tyrrhenian marble they're made of is worn down by centuries and centuries of people touching them and kissing them, but that they're out in the weather. Next to the Cathedral of St. Paul, Lateran. It's sort of interesting that in these years, Gregory, like most Catholics of those years, thought the world was coming to an end very soon. So he left politics and became a monk and retired into a small part of his palace, emptied now of furniture, of comfort, and of servants. And there he prayed and fasted to expiate the sins of the councils that had conquered the world. And his old father, giving his vast fortune to the Catholic Church and the poor, became a priest, and his mother, Lady Silva, entered a convent. Every day about noon, the people could see along the narrow streets linking the Aventine and the Cilian hills, old Lady Silva dressed in
shoddy clothes, bringing to her son Gregory a small dish of vegetables she had prepared with her thin white hands. For 5 years they waited for the last day. But instead of the last day, something else happened. There arrived news of massacre carried out by the king of the Lombards and of the death of relatives and friends as the great families of the Italians were systematically destroyed. It was a time of flood. The Tiber was even washing away the church's granaries where wheat to feed the poor was kept. It was a time of plague. Gregory commented that one could see the celestial arrows striking the Romans. It was a time of war. The absence of the emperor left a power vacuum that only the church could fill, and the new pope, both a priest and a ruler, was caught in the pacifist dilemma. He met the situation by holding a march, not of protest, but of penitence. The secular city was to disown herself, to be born again as a holy city. It was a morning in Lent. The year was 590. All the men assembled in one basilica, the women in another, the widows in a third, and the children in a fourth. In the same way, the nuns, the monks, and the clergy assembled separately. At a signal of bells, the seven lines turned toward the Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore in a collective expiation for the triumphal possessions that had once ascended these streets. As they neared St. Peter's, there's a legend and tradition that says that the Archangel Michael appeared above Hadrian's tomb, sheathing his sword to show that the plague was over. Thus, the great tomb, with its memories of Hadrian and the boy, became the castle of the angel, Castel San Angelo, that would later hold the most precious of the archives. After the break, more secrets from the archives.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. And I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. And we're brought to you on BreadboxMedia.com, especially for you. So before the break, we were talking about Gregory, Pope Gregory the Great, and what a pacifist he was in his inmost nature. But he had problems. He may have been a pacifist, but the Lombards were still advancing little by little. They were sure of final victory. Gregory suggested to the emperor, why not come to terms with them? The soldiers are not being paid and we're abandoning the defense. Except for guarding the walls, resistance is impossible. We make peace so the city is destroyed. But the imperial government delayed and Gregory again wrote to the emperor. And we have these letters. They are treasures. In the letter he wrote, Rome has been abandoned to save Perugia. With my own eyes, I saw Italians with ropes around their necks like dogs, taken away by the Lombards to be sold as slaves in France. The emperor, offended by Gregory's direct negotiations with the invader, accused him of having changed from a priest to a foolish diplomat. Gregory wrote back, I've been called foolish, it's true. If I were not a fool, I would not have accepted this job of pope or have put up with all I've had to put up with in consequence. A determined effort might have evicted the Lombards, but Pope Gregory had resolved the pacifist dilemma by limiting himself to defensive warfare. Now the warhawks of the time proposed a sudden massacre of all the Lombards at a fixed time on a given signal. Well, Gregory refused. In a diplomatic dispatch to the papal representative in Constantinople, he writes, If I had wanted to involve myself in the death of the Lombard nation would no longer have a king, nor dukes, nor counts, but would be divided and plunged in confusion. But as I fear God, I'm afraid to involve myself in the death of any person whatsoever. I think we can see that this man, Pope Gregory the Great, was a pacifist. But even if he was something like Hamlet as Pope,
where warfare was concerned, he was a vigorous administrator in areas where he had no conflict of conscience. Refugees from the Lombard War were everywhere, and the Catholic Church had the means for large-scale charity. The popes were the most important owners of land and mines in Italy. Sardinia was practically a papal property. So was Sicily, a grain-producing area, not yet eroded by the destruction of its forests. And the coast of the Tyrrhenian Sea and its silver and iron mines were largely owned by the Catholic Church. Gregory, he had founded 6 monasteries in Sicily, sent many letters to the administrator there, urging him to help people in need. Listen to the words of Gregory. "I asked you in our previous letter, most of all, to take care of the poor. And if you knew of people in poverty, you should have pointed them out to me immediately. But you did this unwillingly and only for a few. I desire that you give the woman Pateria immediately, as soon as you have received the order, 40 soldi for the children's shoes and 40 bushels of grain." So these letters reflect the problems of an absentee landlord. He may have had all of this property in Sicily, but not a lot of the goods from there came to Rome. He once wrote, "You have sent us a miserable horse and 5 good donkeys. I can't ride the horse because it is a real nag, and I can't ride the donkeys because they're donkeys. Therefore, we ask you to send us something more decorous." You can see that he was a bit of a character. And he wrote letters to barbarians. The Lombard civilization was flourishing, and Gregory hoped to bring the Lombards, already Arian, into the Roman Church. So they were Catholic, but following the Arian heresy. Their queen was Theodelinda, a Catholic, beloved by her people, and a woman certain of her power and charm. Widowed, she'd chosen a husband by saying to one of her warrior nobles, "You need not kiss my hand when you can kiss my mouth." Anyway, Gregory writes to Theodelinda on her decision to educate the crown prince. "Aldewald is a Roman Catholic. You have given your son the armor of the Catholic faith," he said. In this letter, he mentioned the gifts he's sending to Aldewald, the son: a golden cross to wear around his neck, containing a splinter of the cross of Christ, along with a small box of Persian wood containing a New Testament, and for the little princesses, 3 rings. He wrote, "I ask you as a favor to give the children these little gifts with your own hands, so that our love towards them may be presented by your excellency." Well, Theodelinda had asked for some relics of the Roman martyrs for the chapel of her palace at Monza. The old pope sent her some ampules filled with the oil of the lamps that burned before the tombs of the martyrs in the Roman basilicas. For the student of the papal archives, this last gift is the most interesting. For Gregory had attached to each ampule a strip of papyrus telling where it had come from. Think about it. These little strips of papyrus were preserved in a wooden box up to 1042. After the destruction of the Lombard palace, the box was kept in a marble urn behind the great altar of St. John the Baptist in Monza. Lost? It was lost, but then it was rediscovered in the year 1881, and they are now in the cathedral treasury. These minuscule fragments of writing are all that is left of the thousands and thousands of words that came from the pens of Pope Gregory and his chancellery. The pectoral cross sent for the baptism of the young prince with his splinter of the true cross has also survived in the treasure at Monza. Pope Paul VI asked that it be lent to him to wear on his visit to Jerusalem. You know, one interesting aspect of Pope Gregory is he had a collection of legends. He called them the golden legends. So now, some skeptical historians have wondered whether Gregory himself believed these charming tales that were popular in the Middle Ages. It suggests that the legends may have been written as a public relation project to get and keep customers for the Catholic faith. Well, we know that they had a great appeal for the Lombards. It's possible that people were ready to believe because they'd already seen things that were hard to believe. Actually, Pope Gregory made quite an effort, unusual for his time, to establish the authenticity of these tales. The staff assisting him in his writing included notaries, theologians, and Benedictine monks from his monastery. Among them, Augustine and Mellitus, the future apostles to England. We'll hear more about Augustine later. He took great care to give his sources and the testimony supporting the legends, and often had his assistants make on-the-spot investigations. He was so scrupulous that he burned many of his works without publishing them. Others remained in the archives still unpublished in the 9th century. The example that Maria Luisa Ambrosini gives in her book is not one of his original collections. It's one from New Mexico. She said it's this kind of story. Maybe you know the story. There were nuns in New Mexico over a century ago who had a new chapel dedicated to Our Lady of Light. But when they moved in, they discovered that the builders had forgotten to install a stairway to the choir loft of the 85-foot-high room. They called the builders back, but the builders pointed out that there was no room for it, and they suggested they use a ladder. The nuns rejected this possibility as, well, unseemly. The next morning, a gray-haired man came on with his donkey. He tied to his saddle was a small tool chest that contained only three old tools, a T-square, a saw, and a hammer. He offered to install a circular stairway for them, and 8 months later, when it was finished, of wood without nails, beautifully wrought, and ascending in 2 360-degree curves that seemed to have no means of support, he tied his tool chest on the donkey's back again and disappeared. When the Mother Superior went to the lumber merchant to pay for the wood, she was told that there was no bill because no wood had been bought. On examination, the wood proved to be of a kind that grew far to the north, and the nuns remembered. And the nuns wondered whether it was St. Joseph, the carpenter. That happened in the 19th century. And it was an example of what we call pious legends. Probably untrue, but not definitely untrue. Pope Gregory brought a great deal of beauty into the church in his work on the Gregorian chants, named after him, and his sponsorship of the Schola Cantorum, who sang them. Responsive singing of the Psalms and other passages in the Old Testament and the Gospel resounded in the dusk of the catacombs at the tombs of the most venerated martyrs. It was Pope Damasus that introduced Alleluia melodies. St. Hilary of Poitiers wrote Latin hymns to the rhythm of the legion's marching songs. And St. Ambrose brought antiphonal singing to the West. Talking about legend, there's one tradition or legend that says that the Te Deum was composed at the moment, extemporaneously, by two people, Augustine and Ambrose. While St. Augustine was being baptized by Ambrose, each sang alternate lines, making it up as they went along. Could be true, they were geniuses. Why not? So Gregory revised the liturgy and collected and amended those of the church's chants that he wanted to preserve, assigning different chants to various services throughout the year. For the first time, the music of the Catholic Church was organized into a systematic and well-proportioned whole. Now the original copy of the collection, it was called the Antiphonarius Cento, must have been in the archives library with his other works, but it can't be found. A brief break now, and we're going out with Gregorian chant, the ethereal signature music of the Catholic Church. This is Chuck Coughlin.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is BreadboxMedia.com. Chuck Coughlin back after the break. We've just been reflecting on Pope Gregory the Great and Gregorian chants, which is named for him.
You know, as far as music goes, the part of the Mass that seems to elicit the most beautiful music from the composer and the singers is the Lamb of God on your stay. Seems to have elicited the most fervent, the most beautiful music from composers, whether it's Verdi or Mozart or Haydn. And in the Gregorian chants, the Agnus Deis are particularly beautiful. Listen. This is the music that Pope Benedict wanted to be the standard music, the default music, used in our Catholic masses throughout the world. He asked for it, but he didn't get it. He had very deep and profound reasons for thinking that it should be. We were talking earlier about Pope Gregory's systematic and organized collection of Catholic music, of chants, Enfanarius Cento, and how the original copy has been sadly lost. However, there is a mostly complete illuminated copy in the monastery of St. Gall in Switzerland. That place was the musical center of the Middle Ages. Let me say something about the Abbey Library at St. Gall, because it still exists and it's recognized as one of the richest medieval libraries in the world. And it's home to one of the most comprehensive collections of early medieval books in the German-speaking part of Europe. The library consists of over 160,000 books. 2,100 of these are handwritten. Nearly half of the handwritten books are from the Middle Ages. 400 of these books are over 1,000 years old. These are all being digitized now. And there's 355 of these documents that are available on a webpage. The webpage is a little hard to decipher. Codices Electronicis San Gallensin. That's the webpage. Good luck. Now, we were talking about Catholic music. St. Gall is noted as the place where one of the earliest uses of the neume, where something called the neume was used. What's a neume? N-E-U-M-E, a neume. You know, there's a musical notation that's standard throughout the world. The neume is the ancestor of that. Now, the neume is the basic element of Western and Eastern systems of musical notation. St. Gall has a famous library of ancient writings. The earliest manuscripts they still have are from the 9th or 10th century. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, listed as a perfect example of a great Carolinian monastery, St. Gall's. Well, focusing back on Pope Gregory in Rome and his efforts to create a standardized and appropriately reverent Catholic music.
He reorganized and strengthened the choir, the boys' choir. It's called the Schola Cantorum. He gave funds to it, and they had a dual location at the Lateran and at St. Peter's. The school was composed of young boys, especially orphans, but the training sometimes lasted a lifetime. It had great cultural influence throughout the Middle Ages, since it taught not only singing, but grammar, rhetoric, and ecclesiastical administration. Music wielded together the various elements of the curriculum and was the stimulating force in the study of religious disciplines. And it gave music a status that exotic abuses had compromised. The Roman singers that had existed elsewhere were often chosen because they were good-looking, as much as for their voices. They had all these fancy costumes and varicolored clothing, wore their hair long and loose on their shoulders. In place of all this, the Gregorian discipline had a moral integrity beyond question. According to one legend, Joseph of Arimathea was the uncle of Christ, and after the crucifixion brought the faith to England. Some said Christ himself had spent a few years there as a boy in the company of his uncle. In the inner shrine of Glastonbury Cathedral was a small Neolithic house of basketwork covered with clay, in which they were supposed to have lived. And one wonders whether the boy who questioned the doctors in the temple may have also questioned the Druids. But British Catholicism, strong in the 4th and 5th century, had been almost destroyed by Anglo-Saxon invasions, and Catholic civilization survived only in the western regions. Since Gregory was such a lover of books, he must have read St. Gildas' Book of Tears. Gildas was a poor, very impoverished British monk who had escaped to France, and he described the Britons as a population mild and unwarlike, who even in Roman times, he wrote, stretched out their hands like women to be chained, so that they were never strong in war nor faithful in peace. Once the Roman power was gone, they were invaded by Scots, Picts, and Saxons, and there were terrible massacres. The population came to blows among themselves, and to all this was added accusation among the people of the same family. There was a general moral breakdown, and Gildas denounced, he wrote, that kind of perversion against nature, which turned to evil, which instead should be turned to good. The Britons asked Rome to intervene. They wrote, to Aetius, thrice consul, the barbarians push us toward the sea. The sea drives us back toward the barbarians. All we have is a choice between two kinds of death. Either we are slaughtered or we are drowned. So Gregory decided this should be a mission to England. It was his most personal project. And the men who were to take part in it were Benedictine monks trained in his own monastery. But when they reached France, what they heard about the conditions in England, which you can tell what it was like from Gildas' reports, discouraged them quite a bit. They wanted to return to Rome and continue only because of Gregory's orders. It would have been better not to start a good work at all than to turn back from it. To tighten the discipline, Pope decided to make Augustine an abbot. Canterbury was chosen as the place of settlement because of its royal court. The queen was French and Catholic. Her husband, Ethelbert, dominated the other tribal chiefs and had taken the title Bretwalda, a barbaric translation of the Duke of Italy. Augustine of Canterbury sent him a message telling him that he had come to offer him a kingdom that would never come to an end. Ethelbert was skeptical about the unending kingdom, but he met the monks in the field in front of his castle, enjoyed their processions, enjoyed their litanies. He let them remain and preach. This meeting and what happened later was typical of many such meetings that were to take place in the coming centuries between rulers and missionaries. Ethelbert was finally baptized as a Catholic, and the Pope wrote to him Gregory's words again. Be quick to spread the Catholic faith among the people subject to you. Persecute the worship of idols, destroy the temples of the sacred wood. Elevate the customs of your subjects, exhorting, frightening, correcting, and showing examples of good works. Now the text of that letter was preserved for centuries in an English official document. More important is that the text describes the king's christening, since it is thought to be the first literary document in the English language. It's something you have to realize that a lot of languages like English and Italian and all were not written languages for a long time. They didn't have well-formed grammar for a long time. Now, Gregory's missionaries had come to an island in which a Catholic church was already functioning. Catholic Christianity, like the Britons, had been pushed back into the western part of the island. You could say they'd taken to the hills. There, like the Bronze Age chieftain we know as King Arthur, he managed to organize a resistance. At this same exact time, Celtic activity extended to the islands west of Scotland. Iona, under the royal and gentle Columba, Columbkill, we know him as, became a holy place, and so much a domain of God that even now college students, professional men, laborers spend their vacations there, rebuilding its ancient beauty by heavy manual labor, for no pay, but enjoying the peace of the place. It's from there, from Iona, that the Celtic faith, the Catholic faith, spread to Scotland and northern England. We must fade away to a break again. This is Chuck Coughlin on RedboxMedia.com. I'll fade back in a little bit later.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit RedboxMedia.com.
On Redbox Media, this is Chuck Coughlin back with you after the break. We had been thinking about the Celtic Church in the 7th, 8th, and 9th century. In that period, the Celtic Church had always been Roman in its major allegiance. It recognized the authority of the Pope, but preferred its own way of doing things. It had inherited an aristocracy of intelligence from the Druids. Its learned men knew Greek, and its Latin was uncontaminated by a surrounding Latin vernacular. The Celtic clergy felt for the Roman liturgies the same distaste that people accustomed to King James Version of the Bible feel for the Revised Standard Version. And there were other differences. The date of Easter now seems of minor importance, but these men were too near to the time of the astronomer priests to take a thing like a date lightly. They took it very seriously. Well, some degree of separateness is okay, I guess, if it produces such a charming culture. So learned, yet so close to poverty in the soil. St. Columba, on his death day, inspected the granary to make sure his monks had enough grain to last the year. And St. Cuthbert's description of the 3 loaves of bread brought to him by a young boy angel suggests a home-like heaven. They were living in a world where sea otters warmed the feet of the saints with their breath, where the abbots took off now and then, as the Druid priests had done, to visit God's paradise over the sea. The Blessed Isles. Their garments were fragrant for 40 days after their return. It was a beautiful culture. It was a brief culture, though. And it vanished, and it soon vanished. But it was wonderful while it lasted. The bells of the monasteries ringing at fixed hours, giving the newly emerging peoples a sense of times that barbarians lacked. And it gave them the Christian years. It was finally worked out with its recurrent festivals and Saints' Day, and gave people a more accurate sense of time than we get from our modern calendars. The monks labored. They labored for 1,100 years before it was all taken away from them by Henry VIII. They reclaimed the swampy plains and taught agriculture to English hunters. They show men of the island that had once built Stonehenge the techniques of cutting and squaring stones, of erecting walls, arches, and towers. Many of the young men of the tribes gave their allegiances to the new tribes, the monasteries. Those were the new tribes, the monasteries. They learned to read and write from the New Testament. You see, it's entirely false that the Catholic Church did not promote the reading of the Bible. Who taught people to read at all? How could you read if you didn't read the Bible?
There was a Catholic Church that for centuries, and a thousand years really, more than, taught people to read. And they taught them to read using missals, the New Testaments, and sacred readings. The monks of the Roman Catholic monasteries, like those of the Celtic monasteries, produced illuminated manuscripts that were magnificent artistic creations. Very beautiful. So that the British Isles reached its intellectual takeoff point very rapidly. Poetry of permanent worth was produced by men only a generation or two away from barbarian roots. Much of it is deeply Catholic in its nature and inspiration. Some parts of their literature, like, say, Beowulf, had its roots in Scandinavian folklore, but both pagan and Catholic elements are apparent. Grendel the Mistwalker was still of the Kraken kind, but he was sired by Cain. There's the same mixture of pagan and Catholic elements in the Dream of Rude, where Christ appears as a German hero. So these literate missions produced a great number of documents, and these accumulated in the Vatican archives. Directive letters from Rome and anxious questions from missionaries in the field were all stored away in the archives. The archives were used to source material by an English historian, by a famous English historian, the Venerable Bede, in writing his Ecclesiastical History of the English Nation. He never left England, but he was able to use material from the papal archives. Not only did the missionary fathers leave Rome with documents in their luggage, they would be talking with kings who were likely to ask for proof, but they kept up a continuous and intimate correspondence with the Holy See. Papal letters were carefully preserved, and they were regarded as relics, ecclesiastical treasures. But many of the sources Bede used were brought to England through intentional research and transcription. So this is the way that Bede, on the backwoods border of a vanished empire, was able to use the archives, both the archives in Rome and the archives of England. In time, the flowering culture among the Irish and among the descendants of the Anglo-Saxon raiders were ended by new raids. The Viking invaders, who could pick their time and their place, and they broke through the island's defenses again and again. The beautiful books in the monasteries were destroyed. However, the Vikings themselves eventually became Catholics. Missions were sent to the pagan countries bordering the North Sea, not only to save souls, but to bring the raiders under some degree of control. This worked. In England, a few years ago, the imprint of a disintegrated ship was found in the earth. Among other artifacts, was a spoon. On one side of the spoon, there was an engraved name, Saul. On the other side was an engraved name, Paul. What a baptismal gift for a converted king. You know, most people have heard of the Crusades. How many people have heard of the pilgrimages, because that's what the people of the time called them, and of an earlier time, of the time we're talking about. We've been talking about the 700s and the 800s AD. The Catholic world's first place of pilgrimage was not the Holy Land. It was the tomb of St. Peter. Now, up on a hill, the Lantern Hill, was the residence of the Pope, the center of government of the Church, the site of the Scrinium, the archives, the libraries. But there was another stage for religious and political drama, and another depository for the Church's archives. That was St. Peter's Basilica. St. Peter's Basilica could be called the cult center of the Prince of the Apostles. Like the Lateran, in St. Peter's had an accretion of buildings. Among them were two episcopal palaces built by Pope Symmachus. It was the beginning of today's Vatican. Now, I want to point out that in these years, the open days of the empire had ended. The Pax Romana, the peace that the Roman Empire, by their tremendous military might and organization, had effected, was over. The long period of relative peace vanished when that great power vanished. This is what often happens. There were invasions and immigrants everywhere. Most Italian towns had built walls and towers. In the 800s, it was necessary for the Vatican to build a wall, parts of which are still in existence. In those days, it completely surrounded the Vatican
because they were being attacked by Muslims, by Saracens. But in the Vatican was St. Peter's tomb. It was called the Confession. St. Peter's was richly decorated. It was an earlier building. There's actually been three. In the 7th century, Honorius plated the altar and the main roof with silver and covered the roof with golden bronze taken from the Temple of Venus. In its atrium was the statue of St. Peter.
According to legend, the bronze came from melting a statue of Jove that had been in the Roman capital.
During the period, there was an enthusiasm for breaking and destroying images, the iconoclasts. The Byzantine emperor forbade the use of images and threatened to send troops to destroy this statue of St. Peter.
In a very poignant way, time was already taking its toll on that statue.
Its foot was already worn with the kisses of the faithful. In an apse at the end of the rafforted nave was the Confession, the tomb of St. Peter. It was much changed
from the little edicula that the early Catholics had built on Peter's grave.
The pavement had been raised so that the top of the tomb could be used as an altar. A balustrade separated it from the public, and first one, then two rows of spiral columns gave it the look of a shrine. Above it was a mosaic on a rounded surface, like half of a planetarium dome, in which Christ and the apostles and Peter, under a sun like a great flower, were surrounded by the lambs and palm trees of a Mediterranean paradise. It was indeed the Catholic world's first place of pilgrimage. Even emperors camped in the fields around St. Peter's to pray and leave votive gifts before going to the Lateran. And poorer pilgrims left little offerings in the various coinages of Europe. Councils were held there and anathemas pronounced. When Pope Theodore denounced the heretic bishop Pyrrhus, he went to the tomb and mixed a drop of the blood of Christ with the ink that he used to sign the anathema. Now this place, the tomb or the Confession of St. Peter, was much more than merely being a holy place. It was a sensitive spot where the barriers between the seen and the unseen worlds were very thin. A place where psychic power was believed to be concentrated. A place of divine witness. Here adversaries of the popes deposited their accusations against him in order to lay their complaints actually on the tomb of St. Peter, on his body. Any document someone left at the tomb constituted a most sacred oath. Here the bishops had laid their oaths of fidelity to the church's teaching. Even the popes deposited professions of faith at the Confession. Records of the church councils were placed here to serve as foundations for church law. Here the sovereigns presented their magnificent gifts, their purple diplomas, and deeds of donation of land and power. The Confession became a storage place for the most valuable material, a special and select archive. Sooner or later, some of these documents must have been transferred to the Scrinium at the Lateran, or to other places in St. Peter's Basilica, since the storage space at the Confession was limited. But others remain there.
An archive containing an astounding treasury of history.
Entrusted to the care of Peter, the first pope.
For Setting the Record Straight on BreadboxMedia.com, this is Chuck Coughlin. Thank you for listening.